So, hey, how you
Hi.
doing, Jessica?
I'm doing good. I'm doing good.
You know what? Lesson of the day, do not kill Chrome because Chrome will bite back.
It will, but that's kind of the charm of doing things online, isn't it?
Well, that's the thing about it. It's like stuff like this happens because it's a live show. This is, we're all
Yeah.
learning, we're all doing different things, and Sam did a great job doing everything and coming back up. So this is what makes .NET Conf fun. So today you're talking to way practical t tips to improve your user experience. Right?
Yes,
Perfect.
that is the
Take
plan.
it away.
Thank you. And thank you so much for joining me. There's this old joke about a person who visits the doctor's office, and they're complaining that their arm hurts whenever they move it like this. And the doctors say, "Well, stop moving it like that, then it won't hurt." And that's pretty much sums up what Apple's response was to the people who complain about the signal degradation on their iPhone 4s. If you covered the bottom left corner of the phone, you could get dropped called and reduced bandwidth. Apple's response was, "You're holding it wrong." For me, to even suggest that this is the user's fault is, for me, in lack of better words, not nice. It makes me think about a principle, the principle of least astonishment. If a necessary feature has a high astonishment factor, it may be necessary to redesign that feature, meaning that apps and web pages and all of those stuff need to act in a way that most users expect them to, without surprises. Now, there are a lot of confusion when it comes to UI and UX. And some of you have probably seen this or similar images. We have the classic glass bottle of ketchup, which is the user interface, and then we have the squeezy plastic bottle, which is the user experience. But I don't agree. Then there's images like this, but usually they have this really awful-looking design, and then the after UX is a really sleek, good-looking design. But I'm kind of invested in these ketchup bottles, so let's stick with them. But you can't just simply add UX and think that everything will work perfectly for everybody. So I say that both of them is a user interface, and both of them has a user experience, how we use the bottle. What I'm trying to say here is that both a good and a bad experience is equally much a user experience. Do I have a favorite ketchup package, you ask? Well, thank you for asking. Of course I do. This package caters to both those who want to dip their fries and those who prefer squeezing it all over their fries or whatever you put ketchup on. In Sweden, we put ketchup on everything. We can simplify things and say that the UI parts relates to the what, and the UX parts relate to the how of things. My name is Jessica Engström, and I've been teaching UX to developers for about 10 years. Together with my husband, I do a podcast, I stream here on Twitch, I organize developer events, and feel free to check us out because we have a lot of fun. As humans, we have limitations. Our sight is limited, our attention is limited, our memory is limited, and designing with our limitations in mind will benefit our users greatly. We will perceive the application as faster, easier, more intuitive, and then even better looking, even if we don't do anything with the design. In psychology, there's something referred to as cognitive load. Basically, our brains is similar to the processor of a computer in that way. If we have several processes running at the same time, the computer and our brain will get slower and less responsive. Everything from distractions to conflicting information can pose an issue, or having too much information for that matter. If we overload the user with too many choices or unnecessary actions, we will derail the train of thought that the user have, and we might even irritate them or make them slower or make them rage quit. I'm a rage quitter. Now, when I see this number, there's no way I will remember those numbers. I won't even comprehend the amount of numbers there are here. But if we break those up into chunks, it makes them so much easier to read. And it also reduces the cognitive load. So in a way, credit cards are a very good example of reducing that cognitive load. Let's take a form as a more practical example. We have a lot of data, and we have a lot of input boxes. Not that uncommon. If we are putting the labels to the left of the input boxes, we get a total of 32 visual fixations, 32 places that the user need to look and read. We're also trained to read in a certain pattern. In the West world, we read from left to right and top to bottom, sort of in a zigzag pattern, which you can see here for my awesome drawing skills. But by simply moving the labels above, we are decreasing the number of visual fixation by almost half. But we can still do better. It's easier for the user if we, first of all, make sure that we only ask for what we need. Is it really relevant data what gender I identify with when I sign up for a newsletter? I cannot think of, well, basically a few times when that's relevant. So I remove that. And I also remove the age range, because we can figure that out from the date of birth, if age is of importance at all. And while we're at it, let's also change the date of birth to one single input instead of three dropdowns like this. And I also ask for a full name instead of a first name and last name. We still have a bunch of zigzag going on, so we can squeeze them together into one row instead. So now we have decreased the number of visual fixation down to 9. However, we got a little bit too much information now, so we can't even see the last item here. So here we need to think about, do we really need to ask for your home address on the registration? Or can we perhaps do that at a later state when we are about to ship stuff or something? Or if we really do need it, let's split it up into two pages. Okay, so what else can we improve on? Being upfront with the user will reduce their anxiety or stress about how far they are from finishing. Using a progress indicator encourages completion and might even get the users to trust you a little bit more because it feels more honest. You're upfront with how many steps there are. And here's a really good one. If we give the user a head start by starting your progress indicator with some progress already made, it will increase the number of people that use that form enormously. Because we all want that achievement dopamine, and you already took that step, right? So try that out. Now let's put in a button right in the line of sight going down a straight line, so to the left. And as a bonus, it's also more accessible to have the button on the left side, because if you are using a screen enlargement tool, you won't even see the button at first, unless you scroll like a mile. And while we are talking about that button, what does continue even mean? Am I continuing with creating my account or continue to the next step? Not really clear. So let's change that to next step. Now, in this case, I think we could have been clear enough using only next, because we do have the context of steps with our progress indicator, but it doesn't hurt to be overly clear. So I'm keeping next step. And it doesn't make the button any larger than continue either. So I'm sticking to that. Helping the user with smart defaults so the user doesn't have to think about how you want the data submitted is also really helpful. So if you look under date of birth, you can see instead of the enter your date of birth, we now show the format you want the user to put in, which is very helpful because especially dates differs from country to country or at least region to region. Letting the user know that we have succeeded is also very powerful. In this case, we put a green frame around the input box. However, to be more inclusive, we should always make sure that there are other ways to figure out what's going on other than depending on color alone. So let's add a symbol as well. Another great tool is to mark the active input box and start to automatically mark the first one, even if the user haven't even clicked it yet, because that will also make them want to finish it. In our case, we're using a blue frame that is double the size of the original frame. So if you have trouble seeing color, you still see that it's some change going on there. And display the errors before the user submits the form if you can, and not in a long list. And let them know where the issue is, because if you get those list of items or errors, you first need to read the list and then you need to figure out where the issues are. Instead, show them right where they are. And again, to elevate the color accessibility, we put a symbol together with the color. Try not to blame the user by saying stuff like, you put in the wrong date, or in my case, wrong format. Try to be as clear as possible. Think for the user. Don't make them think, why is it wrong format, or how do you want it? So let's change our error message to reflect that input format we actually want. Because when I started to type January in letters, my help went away, right? So there we go. Now they know what we want them to put in. So with just a few steps, we went from this to this. Again, this is where we started. I mean, we have still things we can improve on, but we come a long way. And this is such, there's so many benefits, not only for the user, but for you as well, because people will actually fill them in. And we do have other things we can improve on, like always have an exit for the user so they can opt out in any time. Make sure you can go back in the UI if they want to change something. Maybe they forgot to put their private email and want to change that after the fact. And also use a contrasting color for the input boxes. So in my case, we're using white on a gray background. But if we were to use a white background, instead we change it to an off-white or gray. But that's a whole other talk for another day. Being consistent, not reinventing the wheel, so to say, will help the user. Following platform and industry standards are important. And the learnability will improve for the user, and it will feel so much easier and faster. This is a leaf, right? So if this is a button, what would it do? Let me tell you what it does. This symbol is from a learning management system we use at a school I teach at, and you clicked it to create a new message. Perhaps not the clearest symbol for that. Me personally, I couldn't comprehend what it was, so it rendered effectively invisible. Especially so because in other parts of this same system, they used the pen, a more standardized way of creating a new message. So they actually had to go about and change it. Now, I think that it was supposed to be a quill, or perhaps show that it's eco-friendly to send emails. I'm not sure. But there is a problem with Create New, because we have more than one standard. Twitter uses both a plus sign and a quill. Outlook is using a pen. We have stars. We have documents. When the list goes on, which makes it hard, because being this inconsistent will slow the users down. And honestly, we're talking about a few hundred milliseconds or so, but all of those milliseconds, they add up. So avoid using different symbols for something that already have been established. Issues with going too far outside the standards and conventions can also be found in the real world. Should you pee or wash your hands here? I would say that for those who sit down doing the business, this makes no sense at all. And for those who usually stand up doing their business, feels vaguely familiar and an accident might occur. Which I think it has, because if you do the work of actually printing out labels and put them on every single wash basin, I think there's been more than one mistake here. So standards. Here's another example. This is from an in-flight entertainment system back when you actually could travel. So I start a game, and the pause button is up here to the right. And I go back and I start another game in this same system, same flight, same everything. And all of a sudden, the pause button is up here to the left. Now, we are creatures of habit, so there's a high risk that we won't even see the button if we keep moving it around to unexpected areas. So don't let your UI elements wander around. Like it or not, if there is a standard, stick to it. Hierarchy is important for many reasons. For example, it will reduce the cognitive load we talked about earlier. As humans, we don't read pages or apps. We scan them. And that makes hierarchy very important. And we need to figure out what is the most important feature of our application, or the most used one, which hopefully is the same thing. But what is the least important? Do we even need to have it on the screen? Things like that we need to think about. So let's look at another example. We have a page with a list of posts. The first thing we can do is use proximity to make it easier for the user to see what header belongs to the preview text, or subheaders, I should say. So let's move that up. And what is it that we want the users to do? We want them to scan this page and click one of the posts, right? So let's make the subheaders stand out a little bit more by either increasing them or decreasing the preview text size. There we go. Now, in our case, I decreased the preview text because it was already quite big. And also, if you want to read it, you can click on it to get the full text. And now that we have a little bit more room, we can afford to move the post down a little bit from the page header, so we get a little bit space up there. So what else can we do to show hierarchy? Well, all posts might not be of the same importance. There we go. The bottom three does not look as important as the others. So I won't read them if I don't have time. Then I just scan the top ones, because when I come into this page, I know that the curators have chosen these ones, or they are either the most important ones or the latest ones. So I don't have to read those if I don't want to. So let's click one of those posts. And now let's ask ourselves, what is the least important thing on this page? I would say that it's the header. We clicked on it because we wanted to read about it, so we already know the subject. And how often do we intend to read the header while we are in this page? Once, twice, maybe? Yet every single time we give it the biggest and loudest of all of the fonts on the whole page. So let's fix that. All of a sudden, the subheaders are now the most important thing on the page. I mean, they are important, but they're not that much important than the content itself. So now I made them the same size, but bold instead. We don't have to be more dramatic if we don't need to. So if we look on the right side, the after, that feels like something I'm going to read. The content is important. And on the left side, we have four in your face element. And I keep reading them over and over again instead of reading the content. And please tell me I'm not the only one who does that. And this is sometimes referred to as interference. If you want the users to navigate through your interface with ease, you need to design things in a way where we take advantage of the natural human cognitive process. So we need to reduce that interference. If things are arranged in a way that we understand the hierarchy, we lower the cognitive load because we don't have to think about that, because you did it for me. You have probably seen tons of examples of this one before. It's much easier to read the written color when it's colored neutral or congruent colors. But when the color of the text is incongruent to the written color, we get interference and we have such a hard time to process it. I mean, we can read it, but not as effective. And here's another example of just that. A lot of the West world associate red with stop and green with go. Therefore, we get a slight conflict here. Giving the user clear instructions and clear error messages makes all the difference. I mean, we all make mistakes, stuff happens. The users will understand that. But if you put up an error message like this, the user will wonder what to do. Should they just press OK? Should they unplug the machine? Should they just throw it out? I mean, it is a catastrophic failure. This error message is just scary. Or messages like this. This is from a Swedish bank. Not helpful in the least. Null, null, and close. The translation for the button is close. Remember these? They have gotten a little bit less scary, I would say. But they often don't tell me much as an average user. Now, research has found that poorly designed error message triggers a physical stress response by raising our cortisol level. So let's take the 404 as an example. What makes a good error message? Well, it uses plain language. And they kind of are in places, but they also have a bunch of technical jargon, which means the user might not understand that. It can even be a little bit scary or hesitant to use it. So let's remove that. And I also remove the outline of the error message to make it feel more like a page than an error message thrown up in my face. We have no buttons, no URLs, not even a suggestion on what action to take next. But a good error message is actionable, like home or retry, or depending on what your page does, we can put in a search box so the user can try to find whatever they were looking for. And here you can see what I talked about earlier. We have a white background, so this search box is a light gray for contrast. Or we can also put in a way to get back to the start page. The message itself should also be short, because it's kind of overwhelming to have to read all that text, and honestly, who does? So it doesn't add to the clarity. Explain how to fix it, if it's fixable. In this example, we get a bunch of uncertainty. It might have been removed, it might have changed name, and it might be temporarily unavailable. So can I simply refresh and it will be solved? Or when is it back up again? Will it be back up again? Is there another option I can do? I don't know. And sometimes we can't provide a solution for the precise issue we were having, but we can give options. So here I made the URL blue, so it looks like you can click on it. We might also use buttons and such, depending on the design of your page and what we are doing. I also added a few other URLs to pages I think can be of interest to the user. If we have a shop, for instance, you could have images or URLs to popular items. And this is smart for us, but it's also going to make the user feel less like a failure, and they might even feel like you are very helpful. Never, ever put blame on the user. Be humble about it. It's not the user's fault that we couldn't cover all things that could go wrong. And in this case, they are not directly blaming the user, but they are not taking responsibility either. And using words like error, something went wrong, something failed, will inadvertently put some blame on the user, and they will feel like they did something wrong or stupid. So in our case, we can remove the red that is associated with error or warning in this case, and we can make it bigger for clarity. And let's be humble about it. Own up to the issue. It's me who can't find it, regardless of what the user typed. And it's also okay to be human and true to your brand. It's okay to be funny and it's okay to be witty as long as we also fulfill the other 5 points. So by doing these 5 steps, we elevated the error message quite a bit. And this, of course, also applies to all types of error messages, not just 404 pages. I really like this quote by Bill Buxton. We must adopt an approach that inherently inspires the right design as well as get the design right. When you are developing, try to remember that there are users at the end. Think about what your app is best at, what is the most important thing, and use hierarchy to convey that. And think about what's least important. Can you remove it completely? And maybe not, then you can move it to a secondary page or something to reduce the cognitive load. And think about how you are communicating with the user. When something goes wrong, keep it clear and understandable. Thank you.
Hey, thank you so much. We have a few, actually, we don't have any questions. We have comments. People are just listening. It's awesome. Great, great content here. Let me bring that up here. All right. So it says, Anime Ismahi says, so clear. I want her to teach me everything. Great job.
Oh my gosh. Thank you. Yeah. You're so nice.
Yeah. It's really great. And actually the most interesting one we've been seeing on Twitter is like this specific tweet from Daniel. He says, listening to Jess talk and discuss ketchup. I mean, UI UX. I really like her presentation style. The funny thing about this is when you were showing this slide, I remember, like, I don't know how many messes I've cleaned up with my boys when we go to a restaurant by using the UI or the bottle, the non-squeeze bottle.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they're little kids. They're shaking that thing left and right, trying to get just an ounce of ketchup. And then half the bottle is out there after they just... So it's just interesting, you know, like something as simple as just like, I just want to get the ketchup out and squeezing it, you know, like you said, UX versus UI.
Yeah.
that is the pinnacle example of this. Let's see.
Definitely.
Now we have somebody saying, hey, .NET Conf, we're having some fun. And then one more on great UX advice, especially don't blame the user. So simple and yet so easy to overlook.
It is, because we don't think that we are blaming the user. I mean, wrong format, it's just clinical, right? It's not you did something wrong, but yet we will feel like it's our fault.
Well, it's you know, in particular, and like when you were showing the example with the 404 page, right? The example on the left, that is the technical error, page not found. Yeah. You know, it just giving you things. Well, it's like, well, what do? Do we just show that error? You know, well, that's the, you know, that is the piece of, the path of least resistance. Let's just show what's there because someone already thought of a message, right? So us as developer, we can typically say, well, it doesn't take any cognitive or any extra load because I'm already busy thinking of every other thing that I have to do. I'll just display the default message.
Yeah, exactly. And I do understand that. And sometimes when you just start to think about, hey, there is a user behind this massive backlog I have, then you start to think differently.
Right, exactly. I mean, a good example of this, I was in a project last year where we had a page that said service unavailable as the error message. And every time we would get into a triage, someone says, oh, someone's seeing the service unavailable page. I was thinking like the default page on the server, which means that there's nothing available. So like even that internal messaging with, I would call it ubiquitous language, just made it difficult to understand within a development team.
Yeah.
So, no, but that's great. Thank you so much for taking the time. Enjoyed the presentation. It was great. Folks, if you have any more questions for Jess, catch her on Twitter at @angstromjess. So she'll have more content to share with you out there. So again, thank you so much.